Here's the crowd of mummers we left last night, acting out their old winter solstice ritual in a St. John's living room.
Now, Turkey Neck, be quick and smart, and with thy sword,
I think you should turn around.
Pierce George's heart!
King is dead!
Now, the official story on Canadian history says that European theatrical tradition arrived in the New World in 1606, when some military officers, lawyers, and other important people put off a play at the Acadian colony of Port Royal in what's now New Brunswick. Unbeknownst to the Department of Canadian Heritage, however, it looks as if a scruffy bunch of Newfoundland mummers should get this honor instead. And the performance might have been more like the kind of thing we're looking at in this living room. So let's just freeze frame this picture here for a minute.
Fly the coon!
Now, presumably, the first mummers' performances in Newfoundland would have been done by English or Irish fishermen settlers, just plain old working stiffs, not a lawyer amongst them, so official history took no note of that, nor of exactly when the first mummer came ashore in Newfoundland. But there is a historical record of when a piece of mummer's paraphernalia came ashore. It was 1583, when an English nobleman named Humphrey Gilbert sailed into St. John's to officially declare Newfoundland a British crown possession. And he brought a hobby horse.
We were in number in all about 260 men, shipwrights, masons, carpenters, smiths, and such like. Besides, we were provided of morris dancers, a hobby horse, and like conceits to delight the savage people, whom we intended to win by all fair means possible.
I'm Philip Hiscock. I've got a PhD in folklore, and I'm an associate professor of folklore at Memorial University of Newfoundland. The first hobby horse came over with Sir Humphrey Gilbert, 1583. Just exactly why he had it, we don't know. He said that he brought it along with some morris dancers to win the hearts of the natives, he said. So I always tend to read that as being a little like, Canadian Tire here in this country, putting ads, running, save like Scrooge and give like Santa. And, I think of it using Christmas for commercial purposes. You know, Sir Humphrey Gilbert, I think, was out to win the, if not the hearts, and the pocketbooks of the natives, such as they had in pocketbooks. And so he was going to use this to entertain them. I'm not sure that it was exactly the same as we think of for hobby horses and mummering today. It's like so many other bits of informal culture that we folklorists are interested in. By its very informal nature, it's poorly documented.
So 4.5 centuries ago, down the gangplank in St. John's Harbour walked a mummer's hobby horse. And what is that exactly? Well, that's the weird three-legged apparition that's just about to charge into this 21st century suburban living room. So let's unfreeze the scene and have a look at it.
If you'd like to see him, we can bring him in.
Bring him in.
Bring him in, he says.
Often mummers carry larger bits of equipment that they can actually get inside of, and the hobby horse is one of these. The hobby horse is someone gets inside. It often has a lower jaw that's hinged, and a string or a rope tied to that hinged jaw, so that they can push the face of this horse, push the face into the face of people, often children, and then snap the jaw together. Often there are teeth made of nails in the jaw, so it makes this metallic snocking noise. Snock, snock, snock.
Question for old Ball. How come you only got three legs?
How come you only got three legs?
The hobby horse is a very frightening figure for children. Children, that's one of the things that really scare children. But it's an important part of the routine when you have a group of mummers who are used to that.
It's not a hobby horse that you'd buy at Toys R Us. Anyway, I'll get under. There's always a blanket attached to the horse's head.
Mummer and hobby horseman Mike Rossiter.
And let's see here now. Okay, I got this on now. And so I'm underneath the blanket, something that covers your entire body except your ankles and your feet, essentially. Just next to the head, you can poke your eyes out just to see.
So you can see where you're going.
You can see where you're going, but you're trying to hide your face as much as possible because you don't want to give up the illusion. So I have this tiny, tiny vision. And so you come out and you just sort of approach audience members and you try to get as close as possible. Now, it's hard to judge how close you're getting.
So you make a mistake sometimes?
I have. I've made mistakes sometimes. I've gotten too close and snapped people's dresses or, you know, close to people's drinks. But I find the reaction is they're always fearful at first. So, you know, if you get really close, they always will jump back or sometimes jump out of their seat or whatever, you know. And
so the object is what? To just terrify people? Or
there's an element of fear, or not terror, but it's like the boogeyman, I guess, you know. It's the horse answers to no one. So he is menacing. He is very frightful, you know.
Ball, make your obedience known to the audience. Sit down, Ball. Ball, sit down. Sit down, Ball, sit down. Sit down, Ball.
Even though informal culture is poorly documented, like Philip Hiscock says, if we want to see where Newfoundland mummers originally came from, we could try a little amateur detective work on this hobby horse. We know that the odd creature dancing and snapping its jaws in this modern St. John's living room had one of its ancestors arrive here on a ship 422 years ago. We know the name of the ship. It was the Golden Hind. And we know where she set sail from, the port of Plymouth in Devon, England. This is 21st century Devon, the seaside town of Minehead, 100 miles from Plymouth. And here, coming down the high street, is a hobby horse. The Minehead horse is bigger and longer than its Newfoundland cousin, painted and decorated with ribbons and rags, and accompanied by half a dozen musicians. It twirls and teases the onlookers, then chases them up the street. Neil Miller is inside the horse, although the only part of him you can see is his feet.
Once I'm inside it, it's just like a Jekyll and Hyde, if you know what I mean. I just lose it. And I do completely lose it. You take on the character of the horse. It seems to have an effect on you when you're in there, and I'm hearing it, and it's telling me what to do. I know this might sound stupid, but it's telling me what to do. And I do exactly what she wants to do.
What the horse is telling Neil Miller to do, apparently, is to go nuts.
I believe the devil's involved in it myself. I really do think that the devil's got something involved with it. Because when I get in it, it's just, I lose it a bit, if you know what I mean. It's something about her. And I can't stand to see it carried quietly. I like to tease people. I'll go back into the band. I'll knock them all over the place and knock them completely out of rhythm. And they'll look back. They're calling me all the names under the sun. And I'm walking up the road and I'm laughing. And I think to myself, I've done it again. You know, if I see a pretty young lady walking down the road, then I'll aim for her. If she goes into a shop, I'll follow her in the shop. I've been in Chinese restaurants with it, Indian restaurants, China shops I've been into it. There's nothing that I can't. You know, I will take this wherever, if I see a pretty woman, then I'll go after her. I've got this reputation about being a little bit mad.
Carrying the hobby horse goes back generations in Neil Miller's family. His mother, Joan.
My great-grandfather was in the hobby horse. Then my grandfather, then my father, and then my boys. And my earliest memory was when my my father was always drunk hobby horse time, always. He never sober. My mother used to hate it. And this particular day, my father was rather rowdy and very noisy at home and had a real good bust-up in the house before he left for hobby horse. Got down to the beach hotel and the rope of the hobby horse goes around the neck and down through to the back of the tail. And some children were playing with the tail instead of jumping on it. And one of the old member of the crew, shouted, he used to call my father horse because he was connected with the hobby horse, and said, don't do that. Jump, get him away from the tail. They'll choke horse. And my mother turned around and said to the children, you stay there and choke him. He used to get to my mother so much. I see a difference in my two boys when it's hobby horse time. They get quite excitable and aggressive, and nobody would dare say a word to them indoors. They listen to me all the year round, but hobby horse time, they do as they like.
Right then! Here, hard, mind, hard!
Up the road, Mrs. Miller's boys are about to perform the booty ceremony.
Right then! Come on then!
All together then!
All together now!
This involves the horse ceremoniously lowering its rear end up and down over a woman bystander. Everybody does keep their clothes on, but tradition says if you're booted by the Minehead hobby horse, you'll be pregnant within the year.
We've had women come up to us in the past that haven't been able to have children, and they've heard about this thing, and they've gone under it to be booted, and 9 months later they're pregnant. Now, whether it's the guy on the horse, or whether it's the horse itself or not, or whether it's her own husband, we don't know. Some people call it a fertility drug, but
this is where the fertility bit comes in with the hobby horse. You know, we've had two or three different girls
come to us from anywhere in the country
and tried to have children. Now, whether it might sound stupid, but they've come in underneath here and been booted, and they're pregnant.
Yeah, within a year they're pregnant.
And I'm pretty good at that one.
But there is one aspect of this hobby horse detective story that doesn't seem to fit. Here in Minehead, the horse comes out not at Christmas, but on May Day.
Well, I think that at one time this was mainly a Catholic country.
Folklore collector Peter Kennedy.
We had saint days and all these sort of celebrations were going on at different times. These have been gradually reduced. Well, an example is Christmas now. Everybody thinks that's the only time we celebrate anything, you know. But Christmas was never as important in that way. It was only one of a number of different times during the year that we don't nowadays celebrate. I mean, they get moved around. They're movable feasts, in other words. So the hobby horse can come out in midsummer, May Day, or in the middle of winter, Christmas time, New Year. And they do occur in the mummer's plays, but I think it's the fact that this is a custom that was widespread. At one time there were horses, hobby horses, all over the place. I think the historical records don't help you to discover what this is about at all, because they don't go back far enough. People talk about it being pre-Christian because, of course, there were other religions before the Christian religion, and it may be this is a survival of an older religion. But perhaps it's religious, perhaps it's irreligious. It's something important that you have to say once a year to people, that they remind them of what the world is about, that there are things greater than us. Maybe that's part of what it's about, and that is religious in a way. I mean, it's so if you ask somebody what is the origin of the thing, well, the origin lies inside us.
Well, he's called the hobby horse. Back to the west, they call him the couple bawn, the white horse. We call him the hobby horse.
This is Dingle, Ireland. Patrick Begley is getting the John Street hobby horse ready for Christmas.
See his marbles, his eyes. Marbles, I don't know.
Marbles for eyes, body covered in a white sheet, and a hinged jaw that snocks together.
We normally put a new sheet on every year as well. Like you see him breathing. We kind of build him as light as we can as well. Let's take off his helmet. See, there's a bit of twine hanging off his jaw.
Like in Newfoundland, this hobby horse comes out during the Christmas season. And every year on St. Stephen's Day, the day after Christmas, it leads a procession of disguised revellers through the streets of Dingle Town.
Everybody's disguised, but particularly the hobby horse, he's up front. He goes there and he can see anyone coming up the footpath or somebody in the doorway. he could make a run at them and grab them and more than likely scare the kids at the same time. So you just fall in and wait for the music to start and head off down the street and you'll be going around like that and up and down. Right. Keep going with the music, kind of be dancing along with the music, like, huh? Mm-hmm. You'd have a straw hat on your straw suit hat or a mask. And you disguise your legs and everything. Make sure you're not recognised. Lots of people change their voice even for the day, be talking to people. And how long you can get away without being noticed, the better, like, you know. Some people can do the whole day, not be caught, like. Other people take off their mask just to drink their drink and then they're caught, like. Oh. Yeah, it's good, Craig. Great day. But this guy, he has to be there. He's always there.
And so it is there. December 26th, and there's the white hobby horse leading a motley collection of celebrants through the streets of the town. In Dingle, they're known as the Wren Boys, although not all of them are boys, but it's impossible to tell anyway because everyone is disguised. Most of the marchers look like Newfoundland mummers, in odd outfits with faces hidden beneath veils or pillow slips or Halloween masks, but some of them wear traditional straw costumes that make them look like a walking cornfield. The man in front, by the hobby horse, dressed in green pajamas and a white pillow slip over his head, waving a sword, is Maurice Rohan, captain of the Wren.
Well, I suppose I'm a captain of the Wren possibly nearly 40 years. And that's reality, because I'm 57 and I don't know, maybe 18, 19. But I was very, very enthusiastic and active about it, and on account of that, possibly I was, you know, made captain. But there isn't any such thing as an appointment or anything like that, like, because you don't, everyone who participates are captains in their own sense, and they're all delighted, really.
There are three different parades, or wrens, in Dingle, and Maurice Rohan's is the John Street Wren.
It's a funny thing, the Wren, it's written W-R-E-N, but it's never referred to the Wren in Kerry, but the Wren. If you say to someone, I'm going in the Wren, they say, he's not from Dingle. They do, but it's always the Wren, it's always called. The John Street Wren, the K Wren, Green and Gold, there's different Wrens. But every Wren has usually a headquarters. And the headquarters usually, for obviously, is in one of the local pubs or hostelries.
You might wonder why this custom is named after a bird. In some places, in Ireland, England, and even Newfoundland, the Wren Boys is the name given to children who knock on your door on St. Stephen's Day and recite this rhyme.
The Wren, the king of all birds, St. Stephen's Day was caught in the furze. Although he is little, his honour is great. Jump up, old woman, and give us a treat.
The little Wren Boys might carry an actual bird, or an effigy of one, on a stick. Maurice Rohan's crowd doesn't. So why is it they look like mummers, but call themselves Wren Boys?
I haven't actually the answer to that. All I know that it's a very, very ancient tradition, and that's still nurtured and cherished in the Dingle area. But as regards the actual original origins of it, they're unsure. You know, at traditions where they bring the Wren, the little bird, and where he was supposed, there's a big fable about him being the king of the birds, and that people would hold the little Wren in a stick and go from there. Now, that was never in our Wren. Like, there might be people individually who would have a bird on a stick, but it wouldn't necessarily be part of, it wouldn't necessarily be important. There's no answer, no textbook answer of it, because all it just came down, handed on from generation to generation.
As the Wren winds its way down the streets, they knock on doors, and one of them carries a collection box. The money they collect goes mainly to charity, but partly to finance their stops in pubs along the way.
We have a set way, all right, for marching, and we have a set area. We march the town first, we don't collect, just to let the people know we're the Wren, and we have music, and just to let them see us, you know, at our best. Then we start at the very opposite end of the town. All the Wrens start collecting in different parts of the town. You see, we don't try to clash, we try to keep clear of one another. And we start then, we play the music, then we dance around. going to the local houses, each house along the way. And the houses, many may be looking forward to you coming, really, you know, and they'd be disappointed, in fact, in many cases, if you didn't knock on their door, because it's such a, you know, they appreciate the tradition, they love the people. And many of them, they invite individual people in for a cup of tea or for more than likely a drop of whiskey or a drop of brandy around Christmas time. And we stopped in at designated stops along the way.
9 o'clock at night, the designated stop is Rohan's Pub.
There's no question about it, it's a pre-Christian festival, and it's in the middle of winter where, you know, where everything is pretty gloomy and weather is at its worst.
And there's a cold rain falling outside now, so this is where the John Street Wren will wind up the evening over rounds of Guinness.
It's a big social occasion. To be honest about it, nowadays people don't go out for any particular thing, only for enjoyment, really, and for, to use the word, the crack. But it still has, I think, a deeper tradition than that, because if you think of the time that it was on, it was midwinter, when weather was at its poorest, and people really, I suppose, it was a boost to get out and just celebrate something. And we feel that it's very much, you know, part of the community life, and that also it's a tradition that has, you know, it has given some, it has kept the community together. We have an unbroken tradition going back at least a couple of hundred years.
Any admission for the mummers?
...250 kilometres north of Dingle, in Fermanagh County, right on the border of Northern Ireland. And this group of mummers is visiting a senior's home. There's the usual mix of disguises, but most of them are covered up in strange straw costumes, like the Dingle Wren boys.
There used to be a saying around here that you're nothing but a man of straw. And that means you are worth nothing, because straw was worth nothing.
Jim Ledwith, one of the straw men.
But basically, when you look at it, straw is plentiful in the wintertime for fodder. But it's also a cheap means of creating a disguise about yourself. So that the mask made of straw, and your chest is made of straw, and your gaiters is made of straw, as well as turning your jacket inside out, and putting on big hobnail bits, the wrong feet round, and puffing up your chest with blankets in order to give yourself a bigger appearance. The straw overall is very devilish in appearance. Some of the hats would have a devil, two devil's horns coming out, all shapes and sizes and contortions, with a sprig of holly sometimes crowning the top of the hat to show and to find it that it's Christmas. Some people would say, oh God, it's like the straw Ku Klux Klan. But really, it is a mark of identity that the straw men are out, the mummers are out.
Right, here comes I, Captain Mummer, and all me merry men. Room, room, gallant people, give us room to rhyme. And we'll show you some activity, for this is Christmas time. We like the young. We like the old. Oh. We like what was never acted in any stage before. And if you don't believe in what I say, come in, Beelzebub, and he will clear the way.
Here comes I, Beelzebub.
These mummers perform a kind of play, very similar to the mummers we left back in that suburban bungalow in Newfoundland. Characters speak in rhyming couplets, their lines handed down through the generations in the oral tradition. The two main characters have a battle. One of them is killed, and a doctor rushes in to raise the dead man back to life. That's the entire plot. It's not exactly Broadway, but that's not the point. This is an ancient winter solstice ritual that they say goes back centuries.
The fact is that you have to have the mummers play two enemies, and no better enemies to have than an English enemy and an Irish enemy in the Irish mumming context. So basically you had some of the characters, Sir Patrick or Saint Patrick versus the English hero, Saint George or Cromwell. hear it come. There's a mock fight, and one of those characters is going to be killed. Then this mysterious doctor, using Colton gibberish, total rubbish, and using this magic potion from a way back, and is able to raise this boy again.
And tell me, doctor, what all can you cure?
I can cure many, many things, sir. I can cure things like the big plague, the wee plague, the plague within, the plague without, the pip, the poo, the palsy, and even that old blasted gout.
Oh, that's a lot. You must be very expensive, doctor.
Oh, you'll know that at the end of the evening.
Tell me, would you try the gout there, doctor?
Some people will say, look, I can't handle this. This is people dying, people raising from the dead. There's something mysterious about this. This isn't usual. But given when the play is usually acted out in the midwinter, it is about life, death, when somebody's killed, and rebirth, when the person's risen up from the dead again. And that's pointing to rebirth, and the looking forward to the new year, and the long nights, and the growth in the ground again. It's all about fertility, the symbolism of life, death, rebirth, and the sequence of a play being performed in midwinter, when the night and the earth is at a complete dead.
Now, my friend, on the count of three, my hocus pocus should do the job.
Okay. Right.
Hocus pocus, Sally Compayne, rise up, dead man, and fight again. A one. A two. And a three.
Schoolteacher Brian Gallagher first saw this ritual as a child.
My first memory was maybe I was 6 years of age. There was no electricity. The light of your kitchen was by either candle or lamp, oil lamp, or else a tilly lamp, and it would be casting, say, shadows. And can you picture a crowd of men coming into your kitchen, already big men, rough voices, huge big masks, reaching almost to the ceiling, and they come into your house, you know. And it was really in your face, wasn't it? I remember running straight over to my father and sitting, duking between his knees, and him saying, it's all right, it's all right. And then these guys coming with their rough rhymes, coming with their shuffling dances, and this sort of wild music and wild, you could describe it as almost savagery, you know. It was sort of immediate drama. It was primitive, you know. You could almost imagine it was primitive pagan ritual there in your own kitchen, you know.
Oh, come on, cocks crow in China and echo in France. They come to old Ireland to make Irish men dance. Music!
You're not to refuse mummers entry into your house if they come rapping on your door. You should let them in, or at the very least pass yourself by leaving something for them, even though you don't want them in. But basically it's a good luck to let them in the house, because the nature of mummers is to bring good luck by the performance of their play. But those people who have refused mummers, it's been known that some of the mummers have thrown their hat up into the nearest tree in front of the house, so as to let other mummers' troops to know that this house refuses mummers. There's no payment here. And basically that's a bad luck sign if the neighbours see the mummer's hat up in the tree. That was usually a sign that this is not a good house. A main house, as they would call it here, a main house.
When I started off as a mummer, I was only about 8 or 9, and the reason that I was out at that age was because I could play a flute. I could play a flute, you see, and they were short of musicians. I remember there was an old man taught me the rhymes, taught me whatever I was supposed to say, taught everybody else, and he stressed that it was most important that we kept our faces covered. This seemed to him to be very important. And I remember going to the house, playing the music outside the door. The door was opened, in we went, and I was playing away, and they were saying their rhymes, and finished out the play, and we were going out, and the man of the house, I remember, came over to me, and he slapped me hard on the back, and he said, "You're a great wee fella," he said. "You're a toppin' mummer." And he gave me sixpence, which was a lot of money in those days. And I remember walking down the lane with the mummers, and looking back, and the man was standing in the doorway, you know, with the light around him, and I could see him standing in the doorway. And it was almost like a rite of passage, you know. Somehow I just sensed, even at that young age, that I was part of something that was very important. And it was more than just clowning around, you know, dancing with straw hats. It was more than doggerel rhymes. You know, I remember that night, I did sense that this was part of a ritual that was really the fabric of what society was about, you know, just where I lived and what my parents and grandparents, and that they would have been part of this too, and that I was just continuing it on. I remember, and ever since that, I have always had this sense of the importance, you know, of the mumming tradition.
You probably notice some of these people are talking about mummers in the past tense. That's because here, on the border of Northern Ireland, mummering nearly died out completely.
I'd say there were two big reasons. One was that the church disapproved strongly of the mummers. Now, probably because of excesses. And they weren't spiritual excesses. These mummers' dances became notorious because there was a lot of drinking, there was a lot of enjoyment. They went on all night. In fact, I remember hearing about one mummers' dance that went on for 3 nights. They went on for 3 nights, and the men went home in the morning, they milked the cattle, and went back again to the dance the next night, and they danced and they sang and they drank. And when eventually the porter or the drink ran out, then they went to their homes. But that was an exception. The clergy disapproved, broadly speaking, because in our diocese, there was a rule that dances had to end at 12 o'clock. And after that, it was a mortal sin. Now, this was the way it was, a mortal sin. Imagine a mortal sin to go to a dance that was after 12 o'clock. And I remember being in the chapel and listening to the priest saying that there has been a dance in this area that went on past the hour of midnight. This is a serious sin. In fact, it is a reserved sin, and in order to forget absolution, you will have to go to the bishop's palace. Imagine you had to go to the bishop to get absolution because you attended a mummer's dance. But that was one thing. But the other more practical thing was that the trouble started. And you can imagine that it wasn't the healthiest thing in the world to be travelling around groups of young men in disguise, going up country lanes. Now, you know, you just didn't do it when there was army and B specials and people like that on the road, you know. So it simply became too dangerous.
The early 70s was a bad time around rural Fermanagh. A lot of bombs, a lot of checkpoints. The police would be notified to say if the mummers were coming out. It was just the fear of going out with masks on. That was a bad thing, especially up lanes. Especially up lanes where there may have been previous attacks on neighbours because of their security and force involvement. So that was a real threat to the whole concept of community visits, of house visits. So because of that reason, mumming at one stage was nearly gone, but it never died out. And when things got better, the mummers came out on the road again.
We're not the daily beggars that go from door to door. We're the Acklamad community mummers. You've seen us all before. With our pockets full of money and our bottles full of beer, we wish you all a happy Christmas and a peaceful New Year. Happy Christmas! Music!
So what these mummers are doing in this seniors' home is a revival, really. And afterwards, they pass the hat, raising money not for beer, like in the old days, but to rebuild the village school.
It's unfair to call it a straightforward revival. It's mumming coming good again. And coming good again because there is a community need to raise money for a particular good purpose in the heart of the community. And anyway, it is it's a good luck thing. And in dark, miserable, long, rainy, wet nights, coming up to Christmas, I think that you're going to get a visit by the mummers. A lot of people look forward to that.
It's not that hard to track down other Christmas mummers here in Ireland, or in England for that matter. But back in North America, the only place besides Newfoundland where you'll find mummers is here.
It's where it started, 16th, 17th century. This is where it started, Mummer's Row.
Bill McIntyre takes a walk down 2nd Street in Philadelphia. Weeks before Christmas, this place is buzzing with preparations for the New Year's Day Mummer's Parade.
Right along these streets, my great-great-grandfather paraded. And it's handed down, and my children parade here. We call this Mummer's Row, because all the clubs are lined up across along here. There's a good 30 clubs of the 47 that are represented in the parade that have headquarters down here on 2nd Street, which we call Mummer's Row. We have the Frelinger String Band, and then the Merrymakers, which is a fancy brigade association. And we have the Shooting Stars, and this is our warehouse where we built some of the floats. And we have Quaker City, the world champion Quaker City String Band on the corner. All the clubs, they've congregated down here because this is where the Mummer's Parade started. The immigrants got off the ships not two blocks from here, and they brought that wonderful traditions, all the different traditions that they had, to Philadelphia with them. Now we're outside Quaker City, who are world champions. They started about 1913, I believe. The heritage goes back. Quaker City, because the city of Philadelphia was a Quaker city, run by the Quakers. It was a strict city, blue law city. So you couldn't really raise a lot of hell like we do when the Quakers were running it. But Quaker City were smart. They named it Quaker City. They could get away with a lot more than the most other clubs could back in those days. I knock on the door and see if they're home. Let me see. Here we stand at your door. Here we stand at your door as we stood the year before. Give us whiskey, give us gin, open the door and let us in. Anybody home? Billy, you're in.
Inside, a room full of musicians.
And on the second part.
Quaker City String Band is working on their routine. It has to be really tight because each Mummers Club is allotted just 4.5 minutes for their performance before the parade judges on New Year's Day. Prizes are handed out for the best show, and Philadelphia Mummers take the competition very seriously.
First prize is the ultimate. The bragging rights for the whole year you have, no matter what it costs. It's like hitting a home run in a World Series, kicking and winning field goal in the Super Bowl, and winning the Stanley Cup. All rolled into one, it's paradise.
So you're watching four string basses practice this riff, but don't let that mislead you.
Banjos, take it right on that C minor, where it goes 1, 2, 1, 2, 3, 4.
This is not mummering Irish or Newfoundland style with a couple of fiddles and an accordion in a kitchen. This is Philadelphia, USA, where bigger is better and mummers are valued not by the each, but by the dozen and by the score. This mummer's rehearsal involves not just four string basses, but 22 banjos, four accordions, 50 saxophones, six drummers, one violin, and a glockenspiel. Compared to mummers in England, Ireland, and Newfoundland, this is the all-you-can-eat version.
All right, you have to watch the tempos. All right, let's do the song one more time. Just keep that in mind when we play it.
It's a long process. It's not where you just put your costume on and dance up the street. It's very sophisticated today, very competitive today. More competition today than ever before. But it's an all-year-round project. And the last month and a half is disaster. You just, things to prepare painters to get in and sequin people to get in and designers and everything just comes down to 4.5 minutes. Lots and lots of money. $100,000 maybe in some instances to do 4.5 minute performance. Unless you're a mummer deep in your heart, it doesn't make sense. No return on investment whatsoever. It's no way to making money on it. It's a losing money, but the happiness it brings, the joy and the fun.
T-Rex is called, it's a dinosaur.
Mm-hmm.
And around the other side, we have the head up there that we're working on now. Careful, some of the stuff here.
In the warehouse next door, the Shooting Stars Mummers Club is putting the finishing touches on a 40-foot-tall wooden foam dinosaur, part of a gigantic moving stage set for their New Year's Day performance.
We're doing the supports on this right now. And we have a couple more dinosaurs, smaller dinosaurs. And we have two pterodactyls to build with it.
This week and next week, this whole section has to be done, choreographed, and clean. All right, the last minute and a half. Okay?
In the gym down the street.
Butch from the top.
Do the best we can. All right.
40 burly guys who look like they belong in football practice are practicing pirouettes with a choreographer.
All right, here we go, guys. All right, let's go.
They're mummers working on a Busby Berkeley dance routine to go with the dinosaurs.
These are not people that come from professional dance studios or from Bally's down the shore or Caesar's Palace. These are amateurs. They're truck drivers, longshore painters, bricklayers, plumbers, electricians, doctors, lawyers, policemen, firemen. No matter what avenue you take in life, whether you're a full bird colonel in the Marine Corps, you are a mummer first. Good family values is what it goes down to. Back in the 20s and 30s and 40s, there was a lot of alcohol being consumed on Broad Street. And since the 50s, that hasn't been. But the people still have the old idea that the mummers are hellraisers and they're drunks and they start trouble. We never do. So I took on the task of proving this to my little world here in Philadelphia in the Delaware Valley and around the world, that we are legitimate, good family values. And we also have another way of becoming a little more legitimized, a mummer's mass.
Yes, you heard correctly. He did say a mummer's mass. Mummers may not be too popular with the clergy in Ireland, but Our Lady of Mount Carmel Church in Philadelphia is packed with mummers on New Year's Eve, with their headdresses, gold-painted shoes, and saxophones to be blessed the night before the big parade.
Let there be peace on earth, and let it begin with me.
at St. John Newman's shrine. St. John Newman is the only American male saint. Being a Philadelphia saint, he founded the Philadelphia schools, the Catholic school system in the United States. And he was a little short fellow, about 5 foot tall. But he was big in what he did and what he accomplished in forming the Catholic school system. So a lot of us have gone to St. John Newman High School. And because a lot of the mummers have gone to this school, we decided to petition the Holy Father in Rome. And we petitioned the Holy Father, the Pope. We sent a string band over to play for the Pope, Polish-American string band, to play Polish songs in a private audience. We collected 15,000 signatures over 8 years, and now we have St. John Newman as the patron of the Philadelphia Mummers. We're the only organization we believe in the world that has a patron saint. The Knights of Columbus don't have a patron saint. We have a patron saint, and we have a medal commemorating that with St. John Newman on the front and a mummer on the back. So we're very proud. That's another reason, another way of becoming a little more legitimized.
A gaggle of banjos and saxophones gets ready to lead the congregation out of the Our Lady of Mount Carmel Mass, doing the Mummer's Strut. Mummers got to be such a big deal in Philadelphia and nowhere else in the United States?
We really, truly can't put a finger on it. We are a port city, just like many other cities are, but we are the only city in the whole United States where all of the celebrations blended together and formed this kind of celebration.
Palma Lucas heads the Philadelphia Mummers Museum.
From what we have seen at the Mummers Museum in the 25 years that we have been trying to document this, it came to the new world here in Philadelphia, just like everything else did from the old world. Our earliest settlers were from Finland and Sweden, and they arrived along the Delaware River here in 1640s. Then the English arrived, and William Penn and the Quakers, and the settlement here grew, and the traditions grew. The English brought the Christmas mumming plays. Each part of this folk art just kept growing, feeding off of one another. And by the 1800s, we had more kinds of immigrants coming through, a lot from Ireland. And the end of the Civil War, the freed slaves migrating north, more kinds of influences coming from our own South brought more to the parade, and it just kept growing. By the late 1800s, early 1900s, the clubs were getting very, very large. The parade now is stretched out into four divisions. We had the comics with the early influences. They still have the colonial dress. Then the fancies come up with the very elaborate, large floats. And then we have the string bands. And then last but far from least are the brigades. And their forte, their focus is on themes and dance and props. And this is truly one of the, I guess all the celebrations connected with mummery are, but this one is truly one you have to see to believe. You really do.
And the next morning, New Year's Day, Philadelphia belongs to the mummers.
Happy New Year, say Happy New Year.
It's a wonderful feeling, and it makes you feel good, okay? The Phillies might not win the World Series. The Eagles won't win the Super Bowl. The Flyers, maybe not the Stanley Cup, but there'll always be a Mummers Parade on 2nd Street. Always, forever and ever and ever, for all time. They'll never take that away from us.
It's really difficult to just talk to individual mummer and to really let them know that how far back this, especially the younger ones, let them know how far back and what their history really is and how there are mummers all over the world in various parts doing similar to us yet different. They probably wouldn't believe me. They wouldn't realize that we are part of such a big thing. And it's just something that they do on New Year's Day. Even if you're not a mummer and you're just a Philadelphian, you have to have the mummers on New Year's Day.